This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise. This week on Sea Change Radio, we talked to two people who are working to turn waste materials into cost-competitive fuels, one from the private sector and one from a municipal government. First, we speak with the CEO of LS9, Bill Haywood, to learn more about how his company is making a diesel-like fuel from sugarcane, using an engineered strain of the gut bacterium E. coli. Then we speak with Carrie Ving, who runs San Francisco's cutting-edge SF Grease Cycle program, which is cleaning up the city's 900-mile-long sewer system while helping to fuel the city's transportational fleet with biodiesel. This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. My guest today is the CEO of South San Francisco-based biotech company LS9, Bill Haywood, whose company is using cellulosic fuel technology to create alternatives to oil and gas. Bill, first, tell us, what is cellulosic fuel technology?
Well, cellulosic fuel production is basically taking a cellulosic material, wood chips, miscanthus, switchgrass, corn stover, any of those cellulosic feedstocks, breaking them down, releasing the sugars, and then taking the sugars and then creating fuels and chemicals from those sugars.
And why is your company called LS9?
Well, that's a very secret situation, actually. I think they ran out of really attractive names because there's so many of those out there. So it just means life science company number 9.
Oh, okay.
It's pretty simple.
I thought it might be some kind of a chemical compound or secret to the company. And the company was founded by George Church, is that right?
Yeah, there was really three founders. George mm-hmm. Church, who's one of the top geneticists in the world, mm-hmm. works out of Harvard. Jay Kiesling, who a lot of people in this area know, works at Berkeley. And his counterpart over there, Chris Somerville. Chris runs the BP effort, and Jay Kiesling runs the J-Bay lab. So the three of those folks got together and said, we've got this metabolic pathway. We've got this incredible capability to bring synthetic engineering, synthetic biology, and change the host organisms to kind of harness them to do what we want them to do. So what we're doing, nature's been doing for billions of years, we're just enhancing that with this synthetic biology capability. So they were pioneers, you know, them and some other people, but they said, what can we do with this technology that can really change the world? How about making fuels and chemicals? It hasn't been done before. It's certainly something that is capable with this organism.
And you've divided your product line into two segments, the ultra clean fuels and sustainable chemicals, right?
That's correct.
And is that because these are two different paths for research, or is it more from a marketing standpoint?
Well, actually, the basic process is fatty acid biosynthesis. That's a pretty big word, but what that really means is you're taking sugars, you're running them through, in our case, a host organism. E. coli bacteria is mm-hmm. our organism. Again, it's been around for billions of years doing this process. And we basically harness that to do what we want it to do. It has a unique capability to make these fatty acids become oils and fuels, as well as chemicals. So the core pathway is identical for about 95% of the effort that goes on in the organism. Mm-hmm. You change several genes at the end of the process in the organism, and it makes a difference from making a surfactant that becomes a detergent or a soap, or making a very high quality diesel.
Or a fertilizer.
You can make it's a really rich technology platform that exists, but it all comes from the same host organism.
Mm-hmm. And so can you walk us through the elevator pitch of ultra-clean fuels
Sure.
versus sustainable chemicals?
Yeah, you know, I think there's a big demand for ultra-clean fuels. We call it ultra-clean because, again, I think a lot of the changes in fuel specifications have emanated from California. taking tons of pollution out of the air, taking sulfur out of our motor fuels. And so what we've done is we said, there's no need to create a new fuel. We just want to copy what's made from petroleum, but we do it making it from sugar. So we take 85% of the greenhouse gases out of the manufacturing process. That's where the ultra clean comes in. It's already a clean fuel. We're making it ultra clean by removing these greenhouse gases in the manufacturing process. And we do it with renewable sources. You basically are using things that can be renewed. Crops, in our case, sugarcane works beautifully right now. Ultimately, it will be a cellulosic product, like we were talking about wood chips, any kind of biomass, miscanthus, switchgrass, corn stover, all those things can become sugars once the technology is there to break them down. So right now, we're just taking the sugars and we're using, again, cane juice, but ultimately we can use the biomass as that technology evolves. So you've got the renewable issue here, which is very important, and you also have sustainable chemicals, and there's a lot of push today for green agendas. A lot of the big companies, one of our partners, Procter & Gamble, has a very strong agenda to remove the petroleum content of a lot of their feedstocks and basically replace that with a renewable, sustainable approach.
Can you tell our listeners at home what a feedstock is?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, a feedstock would be the beginning of a manufacturing process. So in making gasoline today that you put in your car, the feedstock would be crude oil. In our case, our feedstock is sugar.
Right.
So what you're doing is rearranging those carbons in the sugar. I think everybody remembers from basic chemistry, C6H12O6, and you're turning those into C10 to C20 chain hydrocarbons, and that's where your fuels come from.
I see.
So yeah, it's a game-changing technology. The other point I'd make is that I think in today's world, we need alternate sources of fuel. In the U.S., for instance, we import 75% of our feedstock for our refineries. So our crude oil comes from somewhere else. That leads to national security issues, just dependence on foreign countries. Most of those countries like us, but some don't.
Sure.
So it kind of puts us at risk. So alternate abilities to create fuels and chemicals from different places, different feedstocks, I think is very important.
Mm-hmm.
Now back to our discussion with LS9 CEO Bill Haywood on Sea Change Radio.
And when you were talking about removing the greenhouse gases from the production process, what about as a finished product? How would that play in terms of its use in automobiles and trucks and transport?
Well, yeah, there is no difference in the quality of the product. So we're mimicking products that already exist. And there's a reason for that. You create a new fuel. You've got to spend a lot of money on infrastructure. You've got to change engine designs. Even electric cars, which are going to be a part of the answer, still require infrastructure investment. What we're saying is, let's make those fuels and these chemicals that exist, but let's make them from renewable resources, which are a lot more benign, a lot easier on the earth, and that they can be replenished year after year by growing crops. So that's where the real advantage comes in. The reduction in greenhouse gases are really in the manufacturing capability. So if you compare our manufacturing, which is a fermentation process, which is very similar to making ethanol, or for the broader audience, making beer. I mean,
right.
It's been around I guess since the Phoenicians or the Egyptians first fermented things to make alcoholic substances, we use the same process to do that. And it's very benign. And if you take crude oil and turn it into gasoline and diesel, et cetera, it requires a lot more energy. Energy creates pollution. It actually creates carbon. So we've got a very low carbon approach and a very cost-effective approach as well.
And can you take a step back and tell our listeners what stage you are as a company?
Sure.
And what are some of the challenges you guys are having that you foresee going from the lab to sure. a factory level production, that kind of scaling?
Well, this company has been around since 2005, and we talked about the founders, some of the really preeminent folks in synthetic molecular biology and genetics. So what we need to do is take these great ideas and move them, just like you said, from the laboratory to commercial capability to the end user. We've been doing that now since September of 2008. We have a pilot plant here in South San Francisco that we went from really shake flask, which is very small volumes, and then 5-liter beaker type fermenters, which we have here in this building, mm-hmm. to this 1,000-liter capability, which is a big scaling jump. And the whole effort here is scaling up these technologies. So the next scaling step we have to do is very large. We're going to go to 75,000 liters, the size of our fermenter. We've just procured a demonstration plant in Florida near Lake Okeechobee, which was an existing plant that actually had gone into bankruptcy. It was working on a different clean tech process. We were able to pick it up at a very low cost, and the beauty of it is time. It saves a lot of time. We don't have to build a demonstration plant. We just have to retrofit this. So by the middle of this year, the retrofit will be complete. We'll be operating in the middle of 2010 to the end of 2010, and we'll have this demonstration step knocked out. So there's incremental steps in taking it from the laboratory to the consumer. This is the last step we have to go through. So your question, where can you buy this? We will be producing about 10 to 15,000 gallons this year in Florida. And ultimately, we can also take that plant and turn it into a large-scale plant where we can actually make 10 million gallons a year in Florida, again, using sugar as a feedstock and creating the same kind of fuels that exist today from petroleum. That is the beginning. That should be done by end of 2011. And then we have a much larger program, and that program will be rolled out wherever, you know, sugarcane is grown. And we have several locations. Brazil is a good example right now. But ultimately, sometime in the next 4 or 5 years, 10 years, when the cellulosic capability exists, we'll be building those plants throughout the U.S., throughout the world. So it's just the beginning, but we're making this high-quality product today. And we're continuing to scale it up and create larger volumes. And the important thing is we can do that at a competitive cost to fuels made from crude oil. So it's very exciting. We like to call it game-changing. It's kind of a key turning point in technologies here to be able to harness these technologies to do what we want them to do. And a lot of that's really happened in the last 5 to 10 years.
Well, the company is LS9, and Bill Haywood, thank you so much for taking the time to walk us through this really exciting new technology you guys are developing.
Well, thank you, Alex, for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
I read the papers, and I got the blues. I'm so sad to hear the news. Help a woman, but not enough. You know these times. Cause no matter what I do, I even pray to heaven above. All I ever get from her is long distance love. Ooh, 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 ooh.
You're listening to Sea Change Radio. Little musical tribute there from Little Feat, honoring the late drummer
Richie Hayward, who passed away at the age of 64 last week. Today, my guest is Carrie Ving, the biofuel coordinator for the San Francisco Grease Cycle Program. It's a citywide effort that diverts fats, oils, and grease away from the sewers and turns it into various biofuels. Hi, Carrie.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. So can you tell us a little bit about the Grease Cycle Program in general and where it is right now?
Sure. SF Grease Cycle was started back in 2006 by the Wastewater Division of San Francisco, specifically to keep this material out of our sewers to begin with. The source of fats, oils, and grease traditionally are residential and commercial kitchens. So a little background information. Generally, there's two types of grease that go into the sewer. Fryer oil that's from commercial fryers, and then the grease particles that are washed off of pans and pots and plates in restaurants and in home kitchens. And for years, the city of San Francisco has been spending about $3.5 million every year dislodging fats, oils, and grease from our sewers, just responding to grease-related sewer backups. So we started this program, SF Grease Cycle, to keep this fats, oils, and grease out of the sewer by working with restaurants. They were complaining that they have to pay grease haulers to come by and collect their fryer oil and have it disposed of. Some of it gets recycled into animal feed. And at the time, the city was just launching a citywide biodiesel initiative. We've been going on about 3 years where the entire city of San Francisco's diesel fleet, over 1,500 vehicles, runs on biodiesel. These are muni buses, fire trucks, street sweepers, ambulances, and they run on 20% biodiesel, 80% diesel. That's called B20. And great start. Largest fleet in the nation to do so, actually in the world to do so. It's been very, very successful. Not a single hiccup. But it's not a home run. The biodiesel that we're using is still coming from thousands of miles away in the Midwest from virgin oils. And there are some food versus fuel concerns there. So
that's you're paying for that biodiesel from the Midwest. So what are you doing with some of the grease that you're turning into waste vegetable oil and other processable liquids?
That was exactly what we were thinking. Why not offer a free service to restaurants and keep the oil within the boundaries of San Francisco? So we started up a program. City workers go out, and they've been collecting cooking oil donated by restaurants. We have over 850 restaurants participating. We collect about 20,000 gallons a month and keep it right here in San Francisco, or in the Bay Area for the most part. That's brought to our Southeast treatment plant, where it's filtered. The marginal bacon bits and rainwater are removed from the grease so that it's a higher quality grease. Those bacon bits and residuals can actually be fed into the treatment plant. And
your treatment plant runs on bacon bits.
The way our wastewater treatment plants work across the country is microorganisms digest our organics, as a nice way to put it. They do the same thing with grease. In digesting this, these digesters turn organics into methane. And that methane is a very valuable gas, biogas. Mm-hmm. So what you have is an opportunity to replace the natural gas consumption of wastewater treatment plants with their own generated biogas, which is a tremendous victory if we can pull these wastewater treatment plants off the electrical grid, because you have over 3%, I'm not sure of the exact percentage, but over 3% of all the available energy across the country is used to treat sewage.
Look, I know I'm dirty and everything, but I just want to talk to you just a minute. I just want a little bit of your time. Hey, girl. I am your garbage man. I come around your house each and every day. I just want to know your name. I am your garbage man. Now look here, I know, but I got something that you might can use.
You're listening to Sea Change Radio. I'm Alex Wise. Now back to our discussion with Carrie Ving of San Francisco's Grease Cycle Program.
So it sounds like there's both your mandate to protect the sewer system, but also this transition into a greener fleet. Are those hand in hand with each other, or are they are the projects a little discrete from each other?
Our main mission as a sewer agency is to protect the sewers. We know for a fact that if we combine a regulatory approach with market incentives, we're going to get cooperation from private industry. But in bringing this restaurant trap grease, thousands and thousands of gallons to landfills, that's not making any use of it, and it's filling up our landfills. So the city of San Francisco, the SFPUC, along with the California Energy Commission, have partnered to do a demonstration, essentially. What we're doing is we're going to be accepting 10 to 12,000 gallons of this pumped out water, oily and food particle water, and take it to our treatment plant, dewater it, which all that water is vitamin water for our treatment plant, because it's going to produce a ton of methane.
And bacon bits.
And then what's left over is, after you dewater, it's about 3% is an oily residue, kind of like peanut butter or oatmeal, if you can imagine. That material is then turned into biodiesel through a private company that we've partnered with for this one demonstration called Black Gold Biofuels. So they're going to take that material, they turn that into roadworthy biodiesel. And all of the byproducts in making that material, this biodiesel, all of those byproducts are, again, wonderful nutrients for our digesters. The glycerin that's a byproduct of making biodiesel is fantastic for our digesters. It's also a natural degreaser to help us, you know, further clean out our sewers. A lot of opportunity there. And the point of it is that as we make sure that the restaurants are doing their job in keeping this material out of our sewers and having the proper grease removal devices, they also pay a lot of money to have these traps pumped out monthly and bi-monthly. If we can somehow, through market mechanisms, add a commodity value to this restaurant trap waste, then it's a win for everyone. It's a win for the small businesses. We're generating more fuel, and we're protecting our sewers.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about the trans fat ban in restaurants and how it does it help you do what you do?
Primarily, trans fats come from hydrogenated oils. And these hydrogenated and partially hydrogenated oils have a thickening characteristic to them. That's what makes margarine margarine and not oil. But it makes it very difficult to recycle into biodiesel because it's in solid form. And we need to have that material be turned into something as close to diesel, which is it's a clear liquid, as possible. It's really cumbersome to work with.
So it can be done, but it's just logistically more difficult.
Yeah.
And probably more expensive.
Definitely more expensive. But it's not something that we pushed for. It's
just a good byproduct of efficiency, huh?
Yeah. Now, all of that material can go into our digesters and be turned into methane. But you're always going to find that if you take a unit of oil and you have the choice between sending it to our digesters to produce methane, or you could turn that into road fuel, you always maximize your BTUs by turning into road fuel. Mm-hmm. And you can think about that in terms of what you pay for a gallon of gas, you know, gasoline to get your car however many miles, and what you pay to keep the lights on for a day. It's a fraction of the cost that we put into our fuel for our cars. So we're really focusing on, if we're gonna have to always move people and fire trucks around, we have to, you know, it's not a personal choice to own a car in as the city government. We have to own fire trucks. We have to own ambulances. We have to run a public transit system to keep cars off the road. So in order to move these vehicles, we might as well figure out how to do it in the lowest carbon fuel application possible. And what we're finding right now is diesel engines can run on biodiesel from cooking oil beautifully. And until we replace the combustible engine, that's what we're going after.
Now, your program was created in San Francisco, which has historically the highest, if not one of the highest, per capita restaurants. And what about some of these smaller communities that are either bedroom communities, ones that are newer developments that don't have older pipes? And would this be replicable somehow in these smaller, newer type of communities where our populations are actually more dense than people sometimes think?
San Francisco is not unique in that we were kind of caught off guard by how bad a problem this is. How bad fat soils in Greece, the fact that they, you know, have been destroying our sewer system, the way eating a cheeseburger three meals a day for 90 years is, you know, destroys a human being. Just going vegan the next day isn't necessarily going to solve the problem. It's going to require a lot of changes in behavior. I would just let other municipalities know that, you know, part of our work with the EPA right now is to come up with a toolbox for other municipalities to replicate what we're doing here in San Francisco. We're putting together a socioeconomic analysis, business case, and just putting all the lessons learned into a useful document for, again, small towns up to very large metropolises to be able to do exactly what we're attempting here in San Francisco.
And where can people find that information?
SF Greece, G-R-E-A-S-E, sfgreecycle.org, and also the SFPUC's website, sfwater.org.
Terrific. Carrie Ving, thanks again for being with us.
Thank you, Alex.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Rodney Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Little Feat, and Ike Turner. Special thanks to Bill Haywood of LS9 and Carrie Ving of the SF Grease Cycle Program. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.